How is everyone? Good? Two thumbs up from Mike. Cannot ask for more. Lane's about asleep, though. So. I believe it. Well, welcome, everyone. It is great to see y'all. And like Courtney said, we're jumping into a new talk series called Unfinished Story. If you're a betting person, you can take your bets now. On how many times I will call it the never-ending story. Because when we were planning this, that came up a lot because we kept on saying, like, never-ending story. It's like, wait, you're going to have a flying dragon that looks like a Labrador coming on here? But that was a weird movie. I thought it was a dog, the dragon. I thought he was a dog until I was, like, 26 years old, and then somebody's like, he's a dragon. He looks like a dog. I like children. So, what this series is about, the Unfinished Story, it's a series about the Bible. A church talking about the Bible. Imagine that. Well, we're going to be approaching it from a different angle. So, instead of going into the Bible for a lesson today, I'm going to be analyzing the Bible as a whole. That is going to be kind of different. If anybody is a fan of mathematics, Daniel, I know you are, knows exactly what I'm about to be talking about. There's a process in mathematics to where if you want to prove something, you can't use the equation as its own proof. You have to go a different way. And we were talking about the story about how somebody originally tried to prove 2 plus 2 actually is 4. But you couldn't just use the... No, you had to go a completely different direction because you can't analyze the equation to prove the equation. You have to go outside of it. So we're talking about the Bible, so we're going to kind of be analyzing it. We're going to be looking at how it is intended to be used and why it was compiled. Essentially, how the creators of the Bible, that is, those who wrote it and also those who compiled it, because it's a compilation of many, many, many other scriptures, and they kept the books... sexual library, they kept the books that seemed to most represent the common thread that was the purpose. So we're going to be looking at how to read the Bible as intended by its authors. That's going to be different because we were not raised in a Mesopotamian culture 10,000 years ago. So it's a very different culture. There were things then that was acceptable then that are atrocities now, but you can see God working with them where they were. Anyway, getting ahead of myself, where's the code word, Corey? You failed me. Hossenpfeffer. Hossenpfeffer. If Hossenpfeffer pops up on the screen, I've either gone over time or talked about a tangent that has nothing to do with today's subject matter. Because I do that. It's how my mind works. My wife compares my brain to an evidence locker room. And that is, I will forget stuff unless you speak of it in the way I last heard it. They're separate boxes, so that, you know, what I need could be in the box right next to the box I'm in. But until I open it, yeah, awesome pepper. Hey, there we go. I can't see it. Oh. Turn around if you want to see how to spell it. That is a mess. Okay, Hossenpfeffer. Now everybody's Googling how to spell Hossenpfeffer. Let's bring it back. Abort, abort. Code word has failed. So with this introduction, my mandate's fairly simple. It's going to be a different kind of talk today. First, I'm simply going to break down what the Bible is not so we can unlearn the misconceptions that have been built by others, primarily popular culture that's completely separate from the church altogether. And second, we're going to outline what the Bible is, as it was understood by the compilers, as is exhibited by the common thread throughout the entire Bible. So, jumping into it, before I get myself even further behind, howsoever, the Bible is not, one, a theological dictionary. Now, we do this as people. You pick up a book, and the first thing you want to do is it, you know, fiction, nonfiction? Is it history? Is it informational? We want to classify it as something so that we can use it for something, but the Bible is not like that. Why? 10,000 years removed, writing was a completely different skill and a completely different purpose. This is a reference book mentality. Using the Bible as a source when it's only helpful when you have a question or a tool for your personal projects. If you have an axe to grind against somebody else and you happen to be a Christian, you might weaponize a verse against them. Is that right? Yeah, if you use the Bible as a weapon against a human, probably should not be doing that. It's not gotcha. It is love. Again, getting ahead of myself. The Bible is not compiled to tell you what to say in a particular situation, nor is it there to tell you to go left or to go right. It's not a science book. It's not a way to one-up somebody who disagrees with your opinion or worldview. Which, I mean, we see this a lot. Somebody is at a rough point in their life and they want the Bible to tell them, do I take the job or not take the job? Do I go hiking or do I go swimming? The best thing I have heard it described as, and this is Tim Mackey, creator of the Bible Project, God's plan is not a map, it's not a path, it's a football field. Well, what's that mean? I mean, you have boundary lines, but whether you throw or pass, that's up to you. Whether you go left or right, that's up to you. Which side of the field you put your center on, that's up to you. So long as you follow the rules and stay inside the boundaries. And you can look at it because the way God does things, he's like a parent telling you not to reach into the knife drawer. Which, of course, what's the first thing we want to do? We want to go to the knife drawer. We focus on the thing we can't have, but we forget the fact that the entire rest of the house is fair game, but oh man, that knife drawer. And so, yeah, so don't use, or the Bible was not compiled to tell you specifically what to do in life. If you flip open the Bible looking to see what job to take, that's using it as a horoscope, which is its own can of worms. We can see the Bible being used as a gotcha reference, quoting it, hoping to shut the other person up. Facebook. All I'm going to say on that avenue is Facebook. You know, there's somebody, you disagree with them, you want to make them get quiet, so you quote a verse, and what I see on Facebook most of the time is they're going against an atheist who thinks the Bible's bunk anyway, so it just rings hollow, completely hollow. I'm like, why did you even throw that out there? They're just going to roll their eyes and not even respond. You have completely wasted your opportunity. We also see the Bible being used as a way to map out spiritual beings, to map out spiritual realms, to you know, get a look of ancient creatures and how the world was once and try to paint, you know, some kind of mythology. This is especially silly if you're paying attention to ancient Hebrew culture, because it was taboo to speak of such things in their culture. You might be wondering what I'm talking about on this. Have you ever noticed that the afterlife is not mentioned once in the Old Testament? You have to dig into Hebrew history books to understand why. It was taboo. Talking about the afterlife and humans going to the afterlife was seen as trying to steal glory away from God. I worried about living God's way, and if I worried about God saving me, I was being selfish. It was taboo. So naturally, this book is not compiled to tell you, you know, where do unicorns go, or stuff like that, because that is not its reason, and that was seen as taboo. You do not worry how God did things. You just worry that he did. Let's see. All the mentions of spiritual beings in the Old Testament are either vague or a really trippy image in a vision. Case in point, Isaiah. Flying snakes that grab hot coals with hands they don't have. That was Isaiah's vision. How am I supposed to picture that? It was hysterical when somebody first pointed that out to me. It's like, okay, there's flying snakes in this vision. It grabs a hot coal, puts it in Isaiah's lips. What do you grab it with? No hands. Tongues were involved, but there were no hands. The second thing, and this one is a doozy. If you don't like it, blame Carrie. The Bible is not a moral handbook or rule book? Now, that's a big one. Let me explain. This is using it as a guide for how to behave, what to do or what not to do, just looking for, you know, a strictly, you know, tit for tat, this or that, you know, way to do things so that you don't have to think about it or be involved. Have you ever noticed that a lot of the Old Testament rules we do not adhere to anymore? I go to Wendy's and I scarf a Baconator without any worry as to my salvation. I don't have to raise a goat and, you know, find my favorite one and take it down to the temple for a sad day. I mean, we don't adhere to a lot of rules anymore that are contained therein, so how do we know which ones to uphold? Have you ever noticed how God told people like Isaiah and Peter to chuck rules that he himself put in place? This bothered me growing up in a church. It bothered me a lot because, you know, you go through all these rules and then you don't get too far into the dynasty of Jerusalem and we don't need them anymore. Why? You didn't do it right. Well, you want us to go back and do it right? No, just forget them. So we went through all this effort and now we're just chucking the rules. Here, let me read Isaiah. We don't have a scripture on the screen, so I'll just read it to you. Isaiah 1, 11 through 13. The multitude of your sacrifices, what are they to me, says the Lord? I have more than enough of burnt offerings, of rams, of the fat of fattened animals. I have no pleasure in the blood of bulls and lambs and goats. When you come to appear before me, who has asked this of you, this trampling of my courts? Stop bringing meaningless offerings. Your incense is detestable to me. New moon, Sabbath, convocations, I cannot bear your worthless assemblies. Just so you know, that is him breaking out everything he built up in the Levitical law as to how they were supposed to live, and he told Isaiah, this doesn't matter. Why doesn't it matter? In Acts 10:13, God shows Peter in a vision unclean animals, and he just strays up, tells him to kill and eat the unclean animals, which Peter says, I cannot. They are unclean. That's against our law. And God says, if I say they're clean, they're clean. So God's making a point, and he's chucking a rule, which I won't get into the Levitical law at all, Hossenpfeffer. So God establishes rules, and he turns around and disavows them. Why? Why would you disavow a rule? I mean, rules are what we live by. They're how we guide ourselves. It's how, you know, schools and, you know, jobs and government buildings don't just disseminate into chaos all the time because there's rules. You know, keep off the grass, don't you gum. Wear a mask. But so why is God chucking rules that he made? Well, he's a little bit more advanced than us. These rules stopped serving his purpose. They weren't accomplishing what he wanted anymore. Rules are made for a specific setting and a specific season, and they're discarded when they're outside that setting or when that season is over. Even in the New Testament, you can see Paul writing letters to churches, advising them on rules, but they were specific to each church's struggle or setting. An example, something controversial in the Bible, which, of course, I love bringing up controversies because we need to talk about them. The island of Sicily, back in the day, it was prime with Roman slavery. That was like their primary, you know, avenue of getting things done on that island. So he wrote them, and he wrote how to be a patriarch in a Roman household, how to be a slave in a Roman household, how to be a son, daughter, mother, everything in a Roman household. He broke it down. A lot of people look at this and they're like, well, you know, I'm going to chuck the Bible. God condones slavery. No. Paul wrote a church. That church was going to have to deal with it because there were slaves in that church and there were slave owners in that church, and he identified each and every one of them in their theater, where they were in society, and gave them rules for where they were at. You got to look at it as it was intended by the author. You got to dig a bit more. We covered in the Trinity series that God does not want rules. He wants transformation. Combing the Bible for specific do's and don'ts does not accomplish transformation because you're looking for guardrails that aren't needed if you actually met Jesus. If you're actually following Jesus, if you actually asked him to change you, if you're actually interested in being selfless and listen to him, you're not going to need guardrails because whatever the situation is presented you with, how do I love this person? Somebody who you starkly do not disagree with, your enemy has a flat tire on the road. How do I love this person? How you feel about them does not enter into the equation. How do I love this person? You don't need a guardrail for that question. Last on what the Bible is not. The Bible is not a devotional grab bag. I'm going to hold myself back on this one. This is a pet peeve. Focusing on the feel-good or easy-to-understand passages while ignoring the true story. Cross-stitched pillows, anyone? This is cherry-picking passages for quick 30-minute sitcom lessons on life, almost always out of context of the author's intent. I'm going to step on my own feet here, because I got a million of these at home. VeggieTales are fun, but they usually miss how the story ties into the overall purpose of the Bible. And when I say they miss it by light years. Who here has seen the VeggieTale about King David? But sire, you have many duckies. There goes the point. Okay, we've derailed. Ducky trucks? I won't ask. Hots and pepper. Hots and pepper. So, 1 Corinthians 13:4. Some of y'all know where I'm going with this. I've cringed at many a public event listening to this. Not because of the verse, because of how it's being used. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but it rejoices in the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. This was not meant to be read at your wedding. It's part of a speech imploring a church to work together instead of competing against each other. And later in this speech, it would call out competition as being childish, and it would establish self-giving love as being the adulthood God has called you to. But you don't get that unless you read the chapters in front of it and behind it. You know, it's a beautiful verse, but it was not meant for, aren't they a cute couple? We have Song of Solomon. Why are we looking at 1 Corinthians for weddings? Life lessons are important, but the subject matter of the Bible is much, much deeper, requiring more inconvenient, diligent study, more than simply recognizing a heartwarming anecdote. This is not Home Improvement. This is a rated R movie where the director wants you to think about what it means to be human. So, I guess, with that being said, I can understand VeggieTales trying to miss the overall point because it gets pretty graphic sometimes. So, the authors of this book literally intended to arrange each book so that you can make a literary picture with the scrolls on a table. Each entry was written to be read all at once. So, you didn't write, you know, books and intend for the readers, I'm going to read this chapter, and then, you know, when the car is, you know, sinking in the water, I'm going to cut it off and go to the next chapter so that, you know, they'll have some suspense for the next chapter. No, they planned the books to be read all at once. Like, anybody seen Minority Report or any modern crime show? Or, you know, What have we got, Rick? And they have everything in front of them. That is how the Bible was written. A good example, if you want to look up Bible Project on Leviticus, they literally, on the video, all it is this display, and they show you the books as they're arranged, and they break down first chapters and last chapters cover this, then the next cover this, then the next cover this, and the most important chapter in the book is the dead center. And we, growing up in Western culture, you know, left to right, top to bottom, that's as complex as our reading goes. We put an emphasis on the last chapter, but that's actually the least significant accent to the central chapter that we should have paid attention to. And we missed it because you got tired reading the book, and so you got halfway, and okay, oh, I'm getting up on the end, this is going to be punchline. But we've actually missed the punchline because it's in the center. Go up, look up that video, Bible Project, Leviticus. If it looks like a scroll, you hit the right one. So it was literally written to be read looking for the big picture. Each book, not by the chapter, by the book. And you have to keep in mind, these people were literary geniuses. They could be reading the end of the book while remembering the start of it. So it's kind of hard, but going through the whole book. I'm not telling you have to read the Bible one book at a time. Break it down as you need, but just keep in mind the context is always the bigger picture. So let's get into the bigger picture. The Bible is one unified story of God's universal plan of redemption. Got it? Good. Let's pray. Just kidding. I thought it would be neat to just put the thesis statement at the beginning and show how it didn't cover everything. So the Bible's broken down into the Old Testament, or Old Covenant, and the New Testament, the New Covenant, as it's called. More on that in the sermons to come. But first you have the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, the Old Testament is an actual library. It's not a collection of books. It was meant to be a library. Each book is a collection of books, per se. It begins with the foundations, the books of the law. It progresses into the history of Israel, and then ends with a diverse group of documents, including prophetic musings, songs, love letters, satirical comedy, and wisdom anecdotes. We've all seen it. We go through the Bible, you get through the law, then you get through the genealogies and the histories, and then you hit the prophets and all these other things, and it seems like it's just lost its mind. Because Job and Jonah seem really just kind of thrown in there. Like, their literary style is completely contrasting to everything around them. And there's a purpose, but I'm not getting into that. Because we have more talks to go in the series. So, after the Old Testament, we hit the Gospels and the letters to the churches. It begins with a few of the firsthand accounts of Jesus' life. These were collected by writers who sought out those who walked with Jesus to get the story straight, because at that time, everyone was talking about him, and it was suffering from a bad game of telephone. You know what I'm talking about? Say what? Operator? Oh, we always call it a telephone because we weren't that sophisticated. But, yeah, it's like, I need to buy soda at the store. And you go down the line, the monkey is giving cataract surgery to the dishwasher. So, yeah, game of telephone. But at this time, how the New Testament was actually compiled was, there were people discussing Jesus, teaching about Jesus and everything Jesus did, and someone said, about 30 years after the ascension, someone said, we need to record this. We need to get an official record. So they went out on foot and found the disciples and got as many living, still living disciples as they could and asked them, okay, you talk, I write. And if you compare the Gospels to the fact that it was, different disciples and nothing but oral tradition, and you look at the consistency thereof, it's really rather remarkable. But that's how that was compiled. Old Testament, that was largely the keepers of the law, the keepers of the Hebrew tradition that compiled the Old Testament and debated, what to keep, what to throw out, but what they kept was mainly what is involved in God's promise. They have one overarching promise, and that was actually the guiding star as to what was kept in the Old Testament, and the New Testament was completely based off this promise. I lost my spot. Salt and pepper. So after this, the aftermath, the actions of the old church, communications between various churches and teachers are displayed in the New Testament towards the end, how they worked and what following Jesus really looked like. So, you know, Paul's letters to the churches, Hebrews is a book of a different teacher. We don't know his name. Was, you know, writing his home church while he was away. These are all like communications between the churches to show you what it looked like back then and what they were working out and honestly kind of learning, okay, we don't need the guardrails anymore. We need transformation and them recognizing that. So how's all this a unified story? I kind of just alluded to this. The Bible is both human and divine in origin. God's Spirit working through humans to accomplish his purpose. Remember how I said don't use the Bible as a grab bag or a tool for your own personal use, weaponizing verses and whatnot, looking for which direction to go, how, you know, should I get the job, should I go left, should I go right? That's using it for your purpose. And I really wanted to say that a second ago, but Hossenpfeffer brought myself back from the tangent. You need to use it for God's purpose. God's intent and mission being recognized by people willing to listen to said Spirit. Those who comprised the Old Testament were known as prophets. The people who actually wrote down were the prophets. Now, when I say prophet, the reality is less spooky, tell the future, and more go against popular opinion in order to agree with God. Prophets were not popular in their day. If you want some proof of this, you can read in the Bible, almost every prophet in the Old Testament was impoverished. And Jesus was also, while he was doing his ministry, he was impoverished. Why? Because they considered him a prophet. Not a rabbi, not a teacher of the law, a prophet. So he was a bit of an outcast because, you know, they did not like what he was saying. Now, prophets, although they weren't popular in their own day, their words became popular after it was seen that they were correct. And this is part of what was, how it was decided to keep, what books to keep and what books to toss for the compilation of the Old Testament. You know, which prophet clearly had God in his ear? Even though we didn't like him at the time, which one knew ahead of time? Being conquered by another nation and have somebody calling it by 150 years? Probably gets your attention. Okay, we weren't nice to Isaiah, but let's keep what he said and keep running with it. The Gospels and Gospels and Company came out of humans interacting with Jesus. So clearly those are human and divine. Just as God's ways aren't popular because they don't win you any fame and fortune, the prophets and disciples were impoverished and hated, yet their literary work lived on because they didn't depend on a sponsor or publisher, they depended upon God. The Bible is a historical document. It was written over the span of thousands of years. The Old Testament was often in debate as to what text should be kept and what text should be not be kept as part of the literary tradition of the Bible. They kept them in the library, but they did not keep them in the Bible's compilation, largely teachers of the Hebrew law. But what was kept was all that was in line with God's mission, the overall promise, the covenant. This is what I alluded to a moment ago. So, essentially, I guess what I'm getting down to is how do we know we can trust what's in the Bible? How do we know that it was God influence and not human influence? Because, you know, we're naturally not trustworthy. Naturally. You know, everyone's trying to trick us. I mean, advertising, that is literally the entire purpose of advertising. Convince somebody it's greater than it actually is, so they buy it. So we naturally are skeptical. It's a good thing. It's understandable. But I would posit that the reason we could trust what's in the Bible is the common thread throughout the entire thing that makes every book line up. That common thread is God's original promise. So what am I talking about? The original promise. Genesis 12, 13. The Lord said to Abraham, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you." That last line at that time should really stick out like a burning star. See, Abraham was the patriarch of a large family migrating away from a land. We know it was called Babylon. That's all we know about it. We know it was called Babylon, and they were terrible, violent people. That's all that's said. But Abraham somehow was a good man coming from this land. But at that time, you looked out for your family. You looked out for your tribe. That's why everybody traveled in caravans, because you can be attacked and you would have to fight back. There's actually stories of Abraham going through this. There's stories of David going through this. Look after your own. Look after your tribe. So when God says, "Hey, Abraham, I'm going to bless you." Great. And everyone's going to be blessed through you. Right now, everyone outside of my family probably wants to kill me. That's the day and age they were living in. So God's saying, "I'm going to bless all nations through you." Oh, okay. From this promise, we go through the entire Old Testament, and we see a lot of human failure and a lot of God rescuing it. If you want to dig further into that, I'll refer you to a Bible Project video, Hossen Pfeffer. So this is the first promise. The entire story was about one family's blessing and all the earth being blessed by them through Jesus. Just FYI, Abraham, his family would become Israel. Israel would bring about Jesus, and Jesus would teach us how to love. So God sought to bring Jesus into creation through this family. Now, I just want to address some misconceptions that this is a good place to talk about them. So going through the Old Testament, there are those who have read it and they start getting a notion of chosen races. Like, oh, why did God send Israel into the land of Canaan to take the Canaanites' land? Oh, it's because they were a better people. They were a better race. But then God later literally talks to the rulers of Babylon and sends them to do the same thing to Israel on the same land. Okay. And God later, you know, Babylon is not in God's good graces in the later parts of the Old Testament. So, you know, the same thing happens to Babylon. Somebody replied. So clearly he's not picking favorites here. So, you know, is God picking Israel as a chosen race of people? What's going on? What's going on is every tribe and nation at that time was violent, and they would go after other nations to take their land. It's actually, I believe in the book of Samuel, it speaks of kings in the spring, literally. They saddled up and went off to war to take somebody else's land. Just nonchalant, you know, like we do. So that was the world then. It was very imperial. So why did God choose Israel to be the conquerors of that land, and then later have somebody conquer them? Jesus was coming from this family. What kind of messed up they were didn't matter. The entire Old Testament, God working with messed up humans. Sometimes Israel was seeking him. Sometimes Judah was seeking him. And then sometimes Israel was seeking him. And then sometimes Assyria was. And then sometimes Babylon was. And you can actually see allusions in the Old Testament. Abraham, don't go into the land because the iniquity of the Canaanites is not yet complete. What does that mean? They're not so far gone that I can't convince them to follow me. so chill. Let a few generations go out, and when they're too far gone, then you can take their land. But there's good people there, so stay away. Abraham listened. Along the same vein, there are those who look at the Bible and think that it's condoning violence, you know, empirical violence, one nation conquering another. Again, God's mission was to bless the earth through Abraham's family. He didn't condone the violence, but he had to make sure this family was not wiped off the earth because all nations were going to be saved by him. This was not, again, this was not God picking the nation of Israel or the race of Israel. This was God picking salvation for the world. It was coming from this family. God does not approve of the cultural failings of the day where this was written. You look at these books, and in this culture, the poor had no rights. Women held no property. And if you conquered a people, they had no rights. And so you look at the Levitical laws. Oh, well, there's laws about slavery, so I'm going to throw out the Bible. I don't like that. There's laws about, you know, women and divorce and marriage. That's sexist. I'm going to throw it out. I don't like that. There's laws about the poor and stuff. I'm going to throw it out. I don't like that. Again, people in that day. In that day, there was no rights for women, no rights for conquered peoples. I guess the technical term would be aliens today, but, you know, if they were foreigners, it's because you conquered them and they survived, so now you own them. But there were no rights for these specific people groups, so you go into the Levitical law, and it writes laws protecting these people groups. Hey, the poor, they could take the gleanings off of anybody's grain and keep it for themselves. And if you have extra, you're supposed to give it to them. Laws for divorce. Hey, if you divorce, oh no, God approves of it, I don't like. If you divorce, you send her to her father with a dowry. So you sponsor her, and then you send him to a guy who can love her. Thank you, Corey. I'm watching. And as far as slaves, the rules for slavery in the Levitical law was called the Jubilee. I do believe it was the Jubilee. It was rules about how to set slaves free after a certain time. Or you could keep them as part of your family. See, God knew that they would look at, you know, the rules, and if he said no more slavery, no more this, they would buck up, go against him, and get themselves wiped out. Once again, looking after this family because this family has the promise of saving the world. So rather than make them buck up against him, he gave them rules like, okay, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it my way. You're going to forgive debts. You're going to feed the poor. You're going to take care of the divorce. You're going to take care of the widow. And if you have a slave, you're going to free them or you're going to adopt them into your family. And that last part should have told them his intentions. It's like, I don't want you to be separate. I don't want you to be violent. I'm going to give you two rules in the subject, and that's free them or adopt them. That should show you God's intentions, doing the best he could with the people at that time. So yes, there's controversies in the Bible, but you have to look at the context of the day and the context of the rules. You know, when you read about these subjects that you don't like, what is God trying to accomplish with that? Which direction is he pushing? So I just wanted to address those. But getting back to the promise, God's overall intent, rescuing the world. You can actually go through the Bible at different points of the Old Testament and see him kind of reciprocating this promise at different points. Kind of restating it, rehashing it, reminding everybody about, you know, what's going on with it. And with the prophets, they always saw it with that lens. I highly recommend reading the books of the prophets in the Old Testament and just keeping Jesus in mind because they all allude to him. You know, the Son of Man, the servant king, the punished one, the broken lamb, constantly alluding to it. And it made no sense back in that day, so people really didn't catch it. The best they could translate is, oh yeah, he's going to be a great general, and he's just going to wipe everything out. I can just see Isaiah looking at him. Okay. Not, you know, I said suffer and die, but, you know, conquer everything. Yeah, sure, I can see. Game of telephone. But upcoming in the series, we're going to be breaking down, like stepping stones, each part of this covenant and revealing more and more of that promise. And I'm trying to keep myself from talking about it because I could biblically nerd out right now. Yeah. Aisha is also holding back up here. She's been grinning the entire time. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's the one thing. But, yeah, you'll have to forgive me. This was kind of an odd talk for me because I'm speaking about the Bible and I can't quote the Bible about the Bible because that would be proving the subject with the subject. So it was kind of difficult not to just pull out so many life lessons, which I know I kind of got into it anyway. Awesome, Pfeffer. But, yeah. So, looking forward to the rest of this series and looking forward to actually getting into the meat of it where we can zoom in at specific points along the Bible. So, be back next week and we'll start to break down in more depth, which I'm really looking forward to, what I'm discussing today about God's overarching purpose and how to read the Bible as one big picture with the context of transforming humanity. All right.